Welcome to viewers here and around the world. I'm Christiane Amanpour, and at the top of the news this week, a global terror alert.
A credible terrorist threat against our country.
The threat from Yemen, and can the United States defeat Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula? Our guest this morning, the president's top terrorism advisor, John Brennan. Then, the final days, countdown to 2010.
This election's not just going to set the stage for the next 2 years, it's going to set the stage for the next 10.
You have to take it?
No.
Hell no, you don't! That's what elections are for.
And the battle for power in the Senate, an exclusive debate between the two top Senate campaign chairs, Democrat Robert Menendez and Republican John Cornyn. Plus, analysis of our new ABC News poll and the politics of coming together.
We work together to get things done every damn day. The only place we don't is here.
All on our roundtable. Tea Party organizer and former House Republican Majority Leader Dick Armey joins ABC's George Will, Cokie Roberts, Jonathan Carl, Democratic strategist Donna Brazile, and Arianna Huffington from the Huffington Post.
From all across our world to the heart of our nation's capital, ABC This Week with Christiane Amanpour starts now.
Hello again. A suspect is in custody and Yemeni police continue to search for more terrorists connected to the bomb plot broken up on Friday. The administration has tied the plot to Al-Qaeda in Yemen. We'll get the latest developments from the president's top counterterrorism advisor in just a moment. But first, ABC's senior foreign affairs correspondent Martha Raddatz explains how this poor country of 23 million people became the major training ground for Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda first used Yemen to launch attacks against the U.S. in October of 2000, when suicide bombers rammed their speedboat packed with explosives into the USS Cole, killing 17 sailors.
We've seen movement for many, many years, recruiting, proselytization of young warriors, young jihadists.
U.S. officials say Yemen now surpasses any other country in the world in posing a direct threat to the U.S. And the man they believe is most responsible for carrying out those threats is American-born radical cleric Anwar Al-Awlaki. The Obama administration has approved the targeted killing of Al-Awlaki, an extraordinary turn of events. Just months after 9/11, Al-Awlaki, who was an imam at a mosque in Falls Church, Virginia, was invited and attended a private meeting at the Pentagon as part of an outreach program to Muslims. But Al-Awlaki knew several of the 9/11 hijackers, had been in email contact with Major Nidal Hassan, the Army psychiatrist accused in the Fort Hood mass shooting, and was directly linked to the failed Christmas Day bomber, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab. We came to Yemen shortly after the attempted bombing, retracing Abdulmutallab's life, visiting the school where he came to study Arabic.
This is the third floor room where Abdulmutallab spent most of his time while he was at the institute here in Yemen. Just a bed, a desk, a closet.
But officials say it was not Arabic he was studying here. He was training at Al-Qaeda camps outside Sana'a and building bombs with the direct help of the American Al-Awlaki.
Getting Americans who understand the culture, understand the way Americans think, and potentially have the ability to come back to the U.S. with clean papers, that is the ultimate weapon for Al-Qaeda in terms of being successful.
U.S. Special Forces are now training thousands of Yemeni troops in counter-terrorist techniques to go after Al-Qaeda, and the U.S. has launched an aggressive campaign of its own. In the last year, there have been at least half a dozen ship-launched cruise missile strikes here, targeting training camps and Al-Qaeda leadership. But the man they are really after has eluded them. The man many U.S. officials believe is likely behind this latest terror plot. For This Week, I'm Martha Raddatz.
We're joined now by the assistant to President Obama for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, John Brennan. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Christiane.
Do you believe that there are any more explosives-laden packages out there, or just the two that were intercepted?
We can't presume that there are none other that are out there. So what we're trying to do right now is to work very closely with our partners overseas to identify all packages that left Yemen recently and to see whether or not there are any other suspicious packages out there that might contain these IEDs.
So is this threat still active? Is it neutralized?
It's a very active investigation that is ongoing. We can't presume, again, that we have identified all of the packages that are out there. We need to make sure that we get to the bottom of this, understand who is behind it and what else might we be facing.
The woman who's in custody, is she the prime suspect?
The Yemenis have announced that the two individuals, a woman and her daughter, are the individuals presumed to have delivered those packages to the FedEx and UPS offices in Sana'a. And so we're working very closely with the Yemenis. They're questioning those individuals right now. We're hoping to get the results of those questions soon.
Do you think there was somebody else involved, or those women deliberately did that?
I think the sophistication of these IEDs shows, at least in my mind, that it was an al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula effort, and that there are a number of people that are involved in this. And so it's not just these two individuals. We're looking for a lot more.
Are you looking for the 28-year-old bomb maker Hassan al-Asiri, who also is apparently alleged to have made the bomb of the underwear bomber on Christmas Day?
The individual who has been making these bombs, whether it be the one that was given to Umar Farooq Abdulmutallab, or whether the one that was attempted to assassinate Prince Mohammed bin Nayef in Saudi Arabia, or the ones that were found in these packages, is a very dangerous individual. Clearly somebody who has a fair amount of training and experience, and we need to find him. We need to bring him to justice as soon as we can.
You say individual. Do you think it's the same individual?
I think the indications are right now, based on the forensics analysis, that it's an individual who's been responsible for putting these devices together. Mm-hmm. The same.
Now, Qatar Airways has just announced that the package laden with explosives that ended up in Dubai actually traveled on two of its passenger planes from Yemen to Doha and then from Doha to Dubai. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that this PETN explosive simply evaded their X-ray screening, their sniffer dogs.
Mm-hmm. It's my understanding.
I mean, that's very dangerous.
It is. And what we need to do is to take a look at the procedures that are in place, the different airports out there, again, working very closely with them, see if there needs to be any type of adjustment of procedures or screening methods or technologies. We need to be able to detect these packages, whether they be on a cargo flight or whether they be on a passenger flight. We've stayed ahead of a lot of these adaptations of al-Qaeda. We need to continue to do so. But that's
can
why we...
you? Because if it's avoiding and evading those screening mechanisms, what can you do, and particularly on a passenger plane?
Well, I think what we've tried to do over the years is to have layered defense and have a multidimensional effort here. And that's why we rely heavily on our intelligence and security services and working very closely with others. We were very fortunate that our Saudi partners were able to support us in this effort.
How did that happen? How did the Saudis tip you off? How did they find out?
Once they received the information, they contacted us immediately, and it was a race against the clock to find those packages, to neutralize them, and so we owe a debt of gratitude to the Saudis. I think their actions really saved lives here.
How did they do it? How did they find it?
Well, I'm not going to go into details about how the Saudis came on to some information, but once they did, they didn't hesitate whatsoever, and they needed to handle that very quickly and pass it to us right away so that we were able to track those down. They were actually in movement, those packages. So it was, I think, a very good example of the cooperation that exists right now between U.S. agencies and our foreign partners.
You're saying that there needs to be better and more procedures put into place to screen these, particularly on passenger planes.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that this has been an evolving process. We continue to upgrade and to enhance our screening procedures and to take stock of attempts by al-Qaeda to penetrate our defenses, and we make adjustments then as well. And so we continue to do it. We've already done it since the discovery of these packages the other day. We have made adjustments in it, and so what we're trying to do is to be as confident as possible we'll be able to detect these packages wherever they may be.
And what about cargo planes, where I understand, and ABC is reporting, that perhaps 90% of cargo is simply not screened?
Well, all cargo aircraft and all cargo coming into the United States is looked upon as something that we need to look at very carefully and identify those packages coming from different places that we need to screen. Sometimes there are different types of screening technologies. Some are with technical means. Some are actual physical inspections. So we look at all cargo coming into the United States as potentially pieces of cargo that need to actually have this intrusive inspection.
Is the United States safe from these threats?
I think the United States every day, I think, is getting safer and safer in terms of ensuring that we're able to take the steps that will respond to the most recent attempts by al-Qaeda to try to penetrate our defenses.
The British say that these explosives could have brought down a plane.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You say, and apparently they were intended for synagogues in Chicago.
They were addressed to locations that have been associated with synagogues in Chicago. The British believe that these IEDs were going to be detonated while they were on board the aircraft, wherever that might have been. But what we have to do is to look very carefully at whether or not they were going to be detonated on the aircraft or they were intended for the destination, and that's where they're going to be detonated.
And very quickly, even though this is a threat and you're saying you're still investigating it, the fact that it was intercepted, the fact that the underwear bomber did not explode in midair, does that show that they are getting more sophisticated or less able and sophisticated?
I think it shows that they are trying to, again, make different types of adaptations based on what we have put in place. So this, the underwear bomber, as well as these packages, are showing sort of new techniques on their part. They are very innovative and creative. We need to stay one step ahead of them. So I think this is a good example of the success that we've had, again, working with our partners, not relying on a single technology or a single screening procedure. We need to have multiple ways that we can identify these types of threats early and stop them before they're able to be carried out.
John Brennan, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you very much, Christiana.
And now on to politics. Our last ABC News Washington Post poll before the election shows that Democrats have lost the mantle of change. In 2008, voters who wanted new ideas and a new direction overwhelmingly supported President Obama. But in this midterm election, 57% of so-called change voters support Republicans. 36% support Democrats. The change label has hurt Democrats this year. Our poll shows that if the election were held today, 49% of likely voters say they would vote for the House Republican candidate in their district. 45% say they would vote for the Democrat. That has narrowed significantly, though, from our last poll in September. But compare it to 1994. Democrats had a 2-point advantage just before the election, and they lost more than 50 seats. Joining me now, the two top senators leading their party's election efforts, Republican John Cornyn and Democrat Robert Menendez. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me.
Good to be with you.
So you saw the polls. Do you feel that you have the wind in your back? Do you think that the Republicans will have the momentum to grab the Senate?
Well, I think we'll make a lot of headway. I'm not predicting that we will get in the majority this cycle. I think it probably is going to take two cycles, but there's certainly a potential there, depending on just how high and how broad this wave election is.
Let me ask you about Joe Miller in Alaska. Our John Carl, political correspondent, is saying that you're basically the GOP is giving up on Joe Miller.
That's not...
Or thinking that he's not going to win.
Well, that's not the case. We are supporting the nominee of our party, which is Mr. Miller, but our concerns...
Do you think he can win?
Well, I think that polls are very close now between Senator Murkowski and Joe Miller. And what we want to make sure of is that the Democrat doesn't win, Bob's candidate doesn't win in November.
And Senator Menendez, your candidate there, you're pouring a lot of money in to hope that he actually can win in Alaska.
Well, we're not pouring a lot of money in,
okay. Last minute ad money.
but we believe that Scott McAdams actually has a real chance of winning this race. Mr. Miller has obviously plummeted because it's about ideology versus about Alaska. Lisa Murkowski wanted to privatize Social Security. Scott McAdams is all about Alaska, so I think he has a real opportunity here.
Do you think, looking at the polls, looking at what we've just seen, do you think this is as bad as 1994?
No, this is not 1994. Number one, in 1994, the Republican brand, its image, was much better than it is today. In every poll, Democrats as a brand fare much better. And secondly, in 1994, it was a surge at the end. We've known that this midterm election is going to be challenging, and so our candidates for the U.S. Senate have been ready for this and have been creating the contrast in each election between their Republican opponent, who wants to bring us back to the economic policies that brought us into this mess in the first place, and their own policies that are working to get us out of it.
Senator Cornyn said they don't think they will get it this cycle, but you're saying that you're blaming the economy on President Obama's predecessor, but clearly the voters are not saying that. They are taking this economy very to heart and very badly.
Christiane, we understand that people are hurting in this country. But our goal is to have them understand and channel their anger on Election Day against the Republican Party that brought us to the verge of economic collapse in November 2008 when financial institutions in this country were ready to collapse.
So why hasn't the message got out better then, for instance, on precisely this issue? A recent Bloomberg poll found that most Americans think that taxes have gone up since President Obama took office, that the economy has shrunk, that TARP, the corporate bailout, won't be mostly paid back. I mean, all of those are untrue. Why is the messaging so bad?
It's true that all of those are untrue. And I think the challenge is when you're hurting economically, and we have gone from negative job growth to positive job growth, from negative GDP growth to positive GDP growth, but if you're still unemployed, none of that news makes that much difference to you. And that's the challenge in this election. Our hope and our message in the contrast is you want to give the power back to the people who got us in this mess, or do you want to continue to move progress forward?
Let me ask you, Senator, because so many of the people we talk to say that they really want to see cooperation, bipartisanship, less of the poison, and solutions. And yet, your leader, the Republican leader of the Senate, has said that if you win in November, the single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president. The Republican leader in the House, John Boehner, said this is not the time for compromise. That doesn't sound like putting partisanship aside and working for the people. Is that the sum total of the policy?
Well, President Obama himself said Republicans can come along for the ride, but they have to sit in the back of the bus. But really, what we need to be focusing on are jobs, spending, and debt. That's what's created this coalition of support, disaffected Democrats, independents, and Republicans that are going to sweep many Republicans into office on November
2nd. I'll get to that specifically in a moment. But the fact that leaders of the party say that, that certainly sets the tone, doesn't it? I mean, that doesn't sound like moving forward. It sounds like another recipe for gridlock.
Well, I don't think gridlock is going to be acceptable when it comes to runaway spending and unsustainable debt and 9.6% unemployment. I agree with Bob that that's why people are reacting the way they are. Now, I don't agree with him about accountability. The administration and Democrats who've been in charge now in the House and Senate for 4 years and in the White House for 2 years don't want to seem to accept any responsibility. I think that's what this election's about, is assigning responsibility and giving Republicans a chance now to deal with the matters that concern them most.
Do you have any hope of bipartisanship? Certainly President Obama's been talking about it. Is there any hope of that coming up?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, we reached out to Republicans from the very beginning. It's not about being on the back of the bus, but when President Obama came to Capitol Hill, when we were trying to get this economy moving on the Recovery Act, before he got to the Capitol, Republican leaders were saying dead on arrival before he even got to engage them. So I thought the number one job that we had was not to make Barack Obama a one-term president. I thought it was about creating jobs and growing the economy.
So the Democrats, it seems, the people are saying, simply have not succeeded in removing people's suspicions about what exactly is health care, what exactly is the stimulus, all of those policies that they're still not quite sure about. The Republicans, on the other hand, have basically said no and moved on. But it has been a very specific-free, substance-free, content-free election. For instance, you talk about moving the economy, but there are no concrete proposals on, for instance, how to slash the deficit. You look at Britain, they have, whether you like it or not, or agree with it or not, put out a really severe austerity program, chapter and verse, dollars and cents. None of that has happened here.
Well, there will be, on December the 1st, a bipartisan debt commission report that I know that we're waiting to see what they come up with. But there will be very specific proposals dealing with debt and spending and to try to get the American job engine, get the people back to work again. Those are the three issues that concern folks the most. And I submit that even if we have a good election, which I think we will on November 2nd, that unless we address those three issues, then we're going to have another election in 2 years where people will throw out those of us who haven't been part of the solution but who've been part of the problem.
Let me ask you about taxes, because presumably that's going to be an immediate issue. People are talking about taxes and the battle for taxes starting right after this election. Is there any way, Senator, that Congress will agree with President Obama's plan to raise taxes on the wealthiest and preserve them for the middle class?
I don't believe we ought to raise taxes on anyone during a fragile economic recovery. And I think there's an increasing bipartisan support for that position. So I hope we'll continue the current tax policy for the near term, perhaps the next couple of years. Perhaps there's a bipartisan solution there.
Well, is there a bipartisan solution? There have been reports, for instance, Senator Menendez, that the White House realizes that there will not be any compromise on what the White House wants to do, and that perhaps one would preserve the tax cuts for the middle for the wealthiest temporarily while preserving them for the middle class.
Well, first of all, we had an opportunity to preserve permanently for the middle class tax cuts that Democrats proposed, and ultimately Republicans held it hostage to giving the wealthiest in the country a tax cut. So what we can have is what the Republican leader in the Senate has, which is saying that he wants to make them all of the tax cuts, including for the most wealthiest in the country, permanent. That's a $4 trillion cost. That's not going to happen, because you can't say you want to be responsible on spending and then spend $4 trillion on tax cuts.
Is there a compromise in the works?
Well, I certainly believe that there may be some opportunity for a temporary approval of some of these cuts.
What, a year, 2 years?
Well, we'll have to see what can be worked out. But what we will not support, certainly what I will not support, is a permanent extension. $4 trillion. You can't talk about spending and being responsible on spending and then spend $4 trillion that you don't have of our collective wealth to the individuals who have the greatest wealth in the country.
Let me ask you about a lot of the money that's been spent in this campaign on ads, on all sorts of things. Not only have there been, you know, strong complaints from the Democrats about a lot of the anonymous money that's going on ads, but some of the ads have been quite sharp in their tone, let's say. David Vitter has run one, which I want to put up right now, his campaign ad.
Charlie Malasa. Thanks to him, we might as well put out a welcome sign for illegal aliens. Malasa voted to make it easier for illegals to get taxpayer-funded benefits. Malasa even voted against allowing police to arrest illegals. Thanks to Charlie Malasa. It's no wonder illegals keep coming.
So some people have called that racist. I want to know, do you think it's appropriate to finger Hispanics in that way?
Well, you...
Do you think it is appropriate?
I wish we had time to show Melanson's ads against Vitter. They are pretty tough.
But let me just ask about this particular ad.
Well, I think border security is a federal responsibility and one that the federal government has simply failed to deal with in an appropriate way. And I think it's appropriate to raise that issue.
But do you think it's appropriate in this way? I mean, you're from Texas. You have a big Hispanic group there. Do you think it's appropriate? Would you have done that?
Well, I didn't write the ad. And
but
I
would you have done it?
I think calling attention to illegal immigration and, you know, for example, this last year, Christine, 45,000 people immigrated to the United States illegally from countries other than Mexico, including countries like Yemen, where this bomb emanated from.
But this is a national security issue. It's the style that I'm talking about, really, not the national security issue. That's all we have time for. Thank you both very much indeed, Senator Cornyn, Senator Menendez. We'll be watching on election night. And as we turn to our round table this morning, we start with a massive rally that packed the National Mall yesterday that speaks volumes about these divisive times. Comedians Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert cast partisanship aside in a music and comedy stand-up routine for civility and reason.
I can't walk on water. I can't see the sun's and daughter.
The rally to restore sanity and or fear was less politics and more just a fun day out in the sun. With entertainment featuring Sheryl Crow, Kid Rock, and others. Faux dueling rockers on the Peace Train.
Peace Train sounding loud.
And the Crazy Train. It wasn't the Beatles, but the message was come together.
Everyone has a right to be patriotic. Everyone.
It's the greatest, strongest country in the world, and there's no one
more American than we.
There was some silliness and plenty of skewering.
Unleash the media. You know what our real problem is?
A country full of Joe the Plumbers.
Crazed teabaggers.
Criminal illegal aliens.
Far-right cranks.
Far-left loons.
Right-wing nut jobs.
Practicing homosexuals.
The lamestream media.
Radical imams.
Un-American bastards.
Fabian socialists.
They are what's wrong with America.
I win again!
The image of Americans that is reflected back to us by our political and media process is false. It is us through a funhouse mirror, and not the good kind that makes you look slim.
What are you fed up with?
I just don't like the way that our politicians aren't talking to each other.
I think that it's raising awareness in the young community, in the young generation now, and I think that's what's important.
It's great to be able to actually have a conversation about being reasonable and being sane, as you know, in a time when there seems to be so much anger.
We work together to get things done every damn day. The only place we don't is here or on cable TV.
And joining me now, George Will, Arianna Huffington of the Huffington Post, Cokie Roberts, political strategist Donna Brazile, and also Dick Armey, head of Freedom Works and a Tea Party organizer, and ABC's senior congressional correspondent, Jonathan Carl. Thank you all for being here. George, nothing wrong with a day out for civility and reason?
Nothing wrong with that.
I saw you rhythming a little bit there.
Nothing wrong with that until you begin to equate civility with the absence of partisanship, as though there's something wrong with partisanship. We have two parties for a reason. We have different political sensibilities. People tend to cluster. We call them parties. And we have arguments, and that's called politics.
Some called it poison, some called it paralyzed. What do you think? Should there be partisanship? Is it an inevitable role of society? Fact of life?
The rally was not against partisanship as such. It was against demonizing your opponents. He said specifically in his speech at the end, which I thought was absolutely magnificent, that of course we'll have animus, of course we'll have disagreements, but we don't have to turn each other into enemies. And at a time when people are going through really hard times, I mean, you talk to people at the rally, I talk to people at the rally, we brought 10,000 people from New York on buses. A lot of these people didn't have jobs or had graduated from college and could not get jobs. So this is a time when demonization and scapegoating can thrive. And this is really a countervailing force.
Everybody says they want the parties to get along. And, you know, my father used to say you can disagree without being disagreeable. And these days people agree and are disagreeable. But I think that the fact is that voters elect politicians who very specifically don't want to get along. And that's going to happen this election more than ever. So, you know, they're saying two things at once. We want everybody to get along. But here's who we're going to elect. Someone who says, I'm going to stand up. I'm not going to compromise. I'm not going to cross the aisle.
Well, yeah, and he actually did poke fun at the cable environment and the media environment in general for focusing on those extremes.
For amplifying the negative and not giving people the information that they need to educate them about the important issues. But you know, the word compromise is a dirty word now. It equals capitulation. If you don't follow the doctrine of the left or the right, you cannot seem to get along with those in the middle. The middle right now is alienated. The right has not captured them. The left perhaps have lost them. So I think the rally yesterday was a way for people who believe in common sense solutions, common sense leaders. They came together yesterday to just basically show that they do care about this country.
The middle is now more people are identifying themselves as independents than in either political party. And that's, of course, why we're having these great swings back and forth.
Let me go to Dick Armey, who's joining us from New Orleans. Dick Armey, thank you for joining us. Are you obviously a big supporter and organizer of the Tea Party? Do you think that there's anything wrong with common sense and civility? Because a lot of people have said that the Tea Partiers are really, you know, helping the extreme end of the spectrum.
No, obviously we need civility. I agree with George Will. You'd
don't be confused between having sharp and sincere differences of opinion and being civil with one another. I thought yesterday was a fun day. I was quite amused at watching these very important national comics stand up and decry with such sincerity that which they do every day on their shows. And, you know, I said, I thought it was so remarkable. I want you all in America to quit acting like we do on our show every night with our militant vilification of everybody with whom we have a disagreement.
Actually, Dick, I don't know when was the last time you watched the show, but that's precisely what they are not doing. I would highly recommend, I'll send you a reel of their last good shows just to see how they don't do that. What they vilified in a civil, reasonable way was the fact that the media have stopped being what they call, what John Stewart called, the immunity of our democracy. And that is something that goes back to Jefferson. The fact that, what we choose to do with our magnifying glass in the media matters. If we only magnify the extremism, that's going to be amplified. Right.
Let me turn to John.
And I am so certain that that makes all the sense in the world to you, Ariana. rest of us don't believe it.
Let me turn to John
Let's face it. It just was a fun day. I enjoyed it. I thought I got a big kick out of it. I'm down here in New Orleans, and I watched that for a while. Then I went out
to the
French
Donna
Quarter last night,
and
I pretty well enjoyed the entire day.
Okay, let me turn to John Carl, because, John, you've been around the country. You've been covering a lot of these races. What are you hearing from people? Because certainly, obviously, asking those there, they talk about wanting much more cooperation in terms of finding solutions for the very real problems that they have. What are you finding?
Well, what I'm sensing is we're going to have a Congress that's going to be far more polarized than even this last one, which has been one of the most polarized Congresses in recent memory. You have a situation where the moderate Democrats or the conservative Democrats that were most likely to work with the Republicans, they are going to be decimated as a group in this new Congress. You're going to have a more ideological, more left-wing Democratic Party, certainly in the House, and you're going to have a more energized and ideological right-wing in the House on the Republican side.
And also, and the people who have been aisle crossers have gotten a very strong message from this election, which is cross the aisle at your peril. Mm-hmm. And the people who have lost in their primaries have lost because they have done that. And so it's not going to be there's no incentive now to try to work together.
Well, and on this note, George, when Mitch McConnell says our prime goal must be to make sure that President Obama is a one-term president, and when John Boehner says this is not the time for compromise, I mean, where does that get the country, in fact?
Well, it gets the country to a stark choice in 2012. We have a presidential system, and he who controls the White House is going to control the regulatory apparatus of the country and the initiative in shaping public opinion. So that's not an unusual thing to say, but let's note one thing. We constantly say there are going to be a Congress full of people who are inexperienced and anti-politics. The following seven states will, in all likelihood on Tuesday, elect fairly seasoned politicians as Republican senators: North Dakota, Missouri, Arkansas, Indiana, Ohio, Florida, and New Hampshire. That's not a rebellion against experience.
Well, let me ask Dick Armey, though, because obviously some of the candidates that you're supporting are challenging the establishment. That's the whole point. And a former Republican leader, Trent Lott, said that once the election is over, we have to co-opt the Tea Party. Is that going to happen?
Well, I think the paradigm shift that you see, for too long, the American people have said, we're tired of having Washington squabbling with one another and telling us what we're going to get. We have decided to assert our citizenry, be involved, and tell Washington what we require of them and what we must have, or they will lose their jobs. This is a great day where America is returning to its foundation root of the citizenry telling the government what we will tolerate from you, what we expect from you, and what we require from you. It is an enormous return to the foundation roots of this great country.
Dick Armey is making the mistake that a lot of people are going to make on Tuesday night, which is overinterpreting the results. This victory by Republicans, which I fully expect them to take over the House, does not mean that the nation is rejecting Democrats and affirming Republicans. It means that they are rejecting the way our institutions are working, that they have deep mistrust of all establishments, that basically our system has not worked for them.
We hear this every time we have a president of one party and a Congress of the same party. The people in that party say, oh, this isn't a rejection in the midterm election. And it is, of course, a rejection. A midterm election is a referendum on the president. That's what it is.
But the people who have a positive view of Republicans is 24%. Please don't tell me that this is an affirmation of Republicans.
How did the Democrats...
It is a disaffirmation of Barack
Obama.
Absolutely,
I said that. But this is not an affirmation of Republicans or of a smaller government or of cutting spending. All the stuff that Dick Armey wants you to believe it is not.
Well, certainly the polls say people want smaller government and cutting spending.
Because the current government has not worked.
The latest poll that ABC Washington Post has just released today says that, in fact, President Obama and the Democrats have lost the mantle of change. The change...
Right.
slogan is now the Republican slogan. How did that happen?
Well, it's simple because after a presidential election, people decide that, you know, okay, we've tried that, let's go back the other way. People are not voting to move backwards. They're moving sideways, and it's like asking somebody in the summer, do you want it to be cooler or warmer? And so clearly voters want change. That's what they're voting for. But I don't know if they're voting for the kind of wholesale change that the Congressman Armey is talking about. Look, the president issued a preemptive call for cooperation from the Republicans in his Saturday weekly video address. The Republicans will have to decide, even if they win a slim majority in the Congress, they will have to decide if they will cooperate or come together to work with the president, or they want to shut down the government. The president will have an opportunity to show a contrast that he wants to govern to get things done, while the Republicans just want to do more to say and take a U-turn back to the mess that we got in.
George, Senator Cornyn pretty much told us that they didn't expect to win the Senate. I mean, made some news here.
Doesn't matter, though, because if Mitch McConnell has 48 senators, he will always have 41 senators for whatever he wants to have 41 for. Let me just say this. The Republican Party is being told to be the party of no. No more stimulus spending, no cap and trade, no card check, none of this other stuff. Gridlock is not an American problem, it's an American achievement. The framers of our Constitution didn't want an efficient government, they wanted a safe government. To which end, they filled it with slowing and blocking mechanisms. Three branches of government, two branches of the legislative branch, veto, override, supermajorities, judicial review.
And we have added to that, the partisan break, yes. So that we not only have institutional gridlock, we have partisan gridlock, which the voters overwhelmingly vote for.
What I'm saying, Cokie, is that when we have gridlock, the system is working.
We become a second-rate country.
But at the heart of this election, and the reason why Democrats have lost the mantle of change is that the administration completely underestimated the economic crisis. And ironically, the president on John Stewart said that when he gave credit to Larry Summers. He said a heck of a job, Larry, effectively, which John Stewart called him on. And that's why they're going to pay a heavy price. They did not expect unemployment to be where it is right now, Donna.
I think one of the things to watch for, though, you know, Christian, is that the president has to watch his left flank as well. This is, extremism is not just on the right, it's on the left as well. And what we do know is that any time a president is challenged in a primary, he loses in the general election. And there's I would not be at all surprised to see this president challenged.
I want to ask Dick Armey again, because I'm fascinated, George, by what you say, that gridlock is good. And certainly there have been members of the Tea Party and others who've been speaking about what might happen after November 2nd. For instance, do you think that there could ever be a time when the Republicans with the Tea Party has shut down government again? I mean, that was raised this week in an interview. Do you think that's going to happen?
No, I think what's going to happen is there's going to be the continuing contest and the big issues. Will the government be in control of America, which will ultimately destroy America, which is right now the obsession of the Democrat Party with their progressive core that controls the entire party, or will it be in fact restrained and responsive to the desires and the needs of the American people? The Republican Party, bless their heart, finally learned in this last year to listen to America rather than to join with the Democrats and telling America what they're going to get whether they like it or not.
All right.
And that's why the Republican Party is going to win,
so,
because they're listening to the voters.
But they may not win the Senate, and Cokie's saying they're not going to shut down government. Do you call, for instance, one of the big issues you're talking about is health care. Would you say that in the first 100 days that the Republican Party should try to roll back health care?
Well, let me just say, if you look at the vote when health care went through the House, the bipartisan vote was no. If the Speaker Boehner puts that vote on the floor, just put it out there, and let everybody make a vote that's between them and their constituents, they will vote to repeal Obamacare, and at least 20 Democrats will vote with the Republicans. I'll guarantee it.
Let me just go to
and
John Carlson.
It'll be a reaffirmation of the original bipartisan vote by which it was passed in the first place with only Democrat votes.
Let me ask John Carlson. John, you heard me ask Senator Cornyn whether they perhaps had given up on Joe Miller in Alaska. He didn't really say that, but they're not expecting him necessarily to win. But you also were around with President Clinton, and he seemed to be making basically don't count us out. Reports of our death have been greatly exaggerated. Is that just wishful thinking at this point?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what he has to say. He also in that interview said that this is, they're doing now what they did in 1994. I mean, Bill Clinton is smart as anybody on this, smarter than most, knows that this, I mean, it's hard to find a Democrat who honestly will tell you they think they still have a chance at taking the House. It comes down to how bad is the loss going to be.
And I want to switch gears for a moment, because I want to raise something that you raised in your column, the issue of the non-issue in this campaign, and that is the war in Afghanistan. Tom Brokaw also last week wrote an op-ed about it, how 10 years in it hasn't even surfaced. How can that be?
10th year of our longest war. This is the most deadly year in the decade in Afghanistan. And it is astonishing that it hasn't become an issue. And what's really interesting is that the rise of the conservative impulse in Congress is going to help the president if he wants to maintain this adventure in Afghanistan.
It's true, though, the president will be helped by more Republicans.
Afghanistan is why the way that we in the media continue to see everything as left versus right completely breaks down. You know, you have George Will and Russ Feingold and me and many people across the political spectrum believing that our presence in Afghanistan is making us actually less secure in the way we're conducting the war. We are spending $2 billion.
Yeah, but the Republicans do support it, and that could be a big help for the president's policy.
No, really. We don't know what a lot of the incoming members feel about it.
Well, nobody has made it an issue.
The fact that it has not been an issue means that they have not had to really take a position on it. And so it's a possibility that you could get a left, white, right coalition against the war. But I think it's more likely, particularly if the military commanders ask for support, that they'll get it.
With all due respect to Afghanistan, I want to get right back to our elections. Last word. This is what I heard in Evansville, Indiana. There's a blue thumb that's going to stop the red wave. These races will come down to 3 or 4 votes per precinct. 94 had a Republican blowout, but you know what? It was close. So it comes down to people still believing that they can make a difference.
All right, and you will be continuing this discussion in the green room at abcnews.com/thisweek. Finally, our pictures this week. Images of those who attended yesterday's rally on the National Mall. And that's our show for today. Enjoy your Halloween. We'll see you next week.